So welcome to you all. For the media people, we are starting the second session on Leslie Silko's novel Ceremony. And day two, we are about quarter to a third of the way through the novel. And one of the things we're going to be focusing on today is the importance of land for Teo, who's the main character in the novel. And this feels appropriate if some of you were at Chuck's Israel-Palestine talk today. He was talking, again, about the significance of the land, the notion of course, Israel-Palestine as the Holy Land, as sacred place, Jerusalem as Jerusalem and the temple as the primary, again, sacred place. We read Psalm 27, which talks about going up to Jerusalem, going up to the temple, and I get a very strong sense of how central, how important that place was. And one of the things that Chuck was saying is that with Jesus, in some ways, one scholar was saying that Jesus secularizes space and time. It's no longer a particular place that matters, a particular time, but of course, in a metaphorical sense, Jesus himself becomes the temple. For Revelations, that's made quite explicit. There's a really lovely passage in a book by Gordon Lathrop called Holy Things, a Liturgical Theology. Since I'm not a Lutheran, I always try to reference at least one Lutheran theologian while I'm here. That way, maybe I'll get invited back again. Gordon Lathrop is the professor of liturgy at Lutheran Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. He's written a trilogy of books on the liturgy, this one, Holy Things. He writes about place in the Christian liturgical framework. You go down your streets and into the meeting. You are not in a place especially sacred in itself. This is particularly true for many of my students. I teach at an evangelical Christian university, and when I ask them about their places of worship, sometimes it's an auditorium, it can be a gymnasium. Place is really not significant for them. Of course, I worship in a cathedral, so place is important to me. You are not at a place especially sacred in itself. You are at a place in your town, a place used for the Christian meeting. But because of the symbolic centeredness of that meeting, the kiva-like abstraction of its central symbols, and I'll come back to that, the kiva-like abstraction of its central symbols, something of the experience of sacred space is suggested here. You are at a pool. The water comes from elsewhere and flows to here, giving a connection between this place and the mountains and the streams. A word occurs and you answer back in the liturgy. You are not marginalized, but here, part of this community, welcome to participate in integrating your own identity into a sense of centered world. A meal takes place. The food comes from here, connecting you to the land. The thanksgiving arises from here. You are welcome to eat and drink here. If this all goes on, then the sense of location is strong, meaning to imply that the world itself is not chaos, but has a center. It may even be that the gathering place will follow the old Christian custom, orienting the meeting toward the east, toward the place of the rising sun. But the sense of being at this place yields a map of the cosmos, being here and waiting for what is coming from there. That's a beautiful paragraph. It's a beautiful paragraph, I think. And it's striking because there's a way in which, of course, the Christ place is secularized. The temple, Jerusalem, are no longer the place to meet God. But I always wrestle with this because to me, also, place is very special. Place can feel holy at times. I mean, here we are in this valley. I've walked in with my camera. I'm not supposed to teach, but I mean, the moon, half moon, just right there in that dip. And darkness coming on, and kids out there playing. I mean, there is something so beautiful about that scene that it does feel holy in some sense. And if we had time, we could easily spend a week just talking about that, about talking about land, about talking about how powerful places can be. Why do we go on pilgrimages, after all? We have a sense of the holiness, the importance of particular places. And that ending of Lathrop's with this notion of being oriented towards the east, towards the sun, as cathedrals often were. If you've been to Chartres Cathedral, you'll find that you actually enter from the west. The main entrance is from the west. Often the baptistry was outside in a separate building. So on the Easter Vigil, you would be baptized. You would be in that way brought into the body. You would walk in through those doors, the western doors. And why west? What's the significance of west? This is not a trick question.
Setting
sun.
Yeah.
Keep going. Significance of setting sun.
Waiting. Waiting, anticipation.
Darkness. Ending of the day, darkness, and by extension,
death.
Sure. So you actually enter through, call it the door of death. You enter, something has to die, and you enter into that space, and you are moving towards the east, towards the rising sun. It's a very powerful symbol. So in Leslie Stilwell's novel, I'm going to recap a little bit for those who weren't here. The novel, in a sense, begins with the word sunrise, separated on a page. And to give the ending away, it ends with sunrise, which tells you a whole lot about the plot. So it ends actually with sunrise, accept this offering, sunrise. So there's an extension from this initial single word sunrise to this notion of sunrise somehow being involved in a prayer, in something being offered up. And that is the trajectory of the novel, in a certain sense. The novel begins, properly, you could say, when we think of the novel as a piece of prose fiction, with a character named Teo, who we discover has returned from World War II. He is a Native American, a so-called half-breed or mixed-blood Native American, who has fought for this country against the Japanese and has returned, survived, but his half-brother, Rocky, was killed. And he bears tremendous guilt for this. Where we left off yesterday was with a scene from World War II where Teo is confronting Japanese soldiers who are prisoners, and Teo is being ordered to shoot and kill one of those soldiers. And Teo looks at the soldier, and he sees in the face of that soldier his uncle Josiah. He sees the face of his uncle Josiah. And he has a breakdown of sorts. He cannot kill this Japanese soldier because it is his uncle Josiah. And Rocky keeps saying to him, Teo, this is not Josiah. We are over here in Asia. Josiah is back there in New Mexico. He's with the cattle. He's doing what Josiah does. There is this very clear separation for Rocky between those two things. And this is, we left with the question yesterday. Is Rocky right or is Teo right? And the answer was?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. This is literature, after all. I'm on lit prof, so it's always both and. 2 plus 2, well, yeah, I guess it equals 4, but you never know. It's, you know, metaphorically, maybe it's 5. So the answer is yes. Rocky, obviously, logically, from a rational perspective, absolutely. It's not literally Josiah. There's a sense of that.
I am my brother's keeper.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And Teo is confused. He is having a breakdown with that sense that this is literally Josiah. But in some fundamental way, he is experiencing something true, more deeply true than Rocky's reality. And this is a central point that Silko is trying to get at. She has a real quarrel with Western rationalism. She was raised, she was taught in, you know, public schools in New Mexico, went to the University of New Mexico. So she is very much within that framework. But she really has an argument with it. in part because of the way it was used against her own people. So that's where we left off. Teo has returned, and in a sense has not been able to integrate that sense he had of the Japanese soldier as Josiah. He is still broken down in some ways by that and by his guilt around Rocky. And as I said yesterday, he spends time in a VA hospital in Los Angeles. They can't do anything with him. They send him home. There's a local medicine man who tries to work with him and who is not successful. And he is eventually sent to another medicine man above Gallup, New Mexico, which is where we're going to get to tomorrow. But today, I want to start with a short passage that we didn't get to yesterday. And this is not in this new handout. So I'll just read a little of it. And I think this will be fine. It's only a paragraph. This is when old man Kouush, who is the local medicine man, the local healer who is trying to work with Teo, is speaking to Teo, helping Teo to heal. And this is the way Silco describes this conversation. Kouush and Teo are together. Kouush waited until the voices of the women could no longer be heard before he moved the chair close to the bed. He smelled like mutton tallow and mountain sagebrush. He spoke softly, using the old dialect full of sentences that were involuted with explanations of their own origins. As if nothing the old man said were his own, but all had been said before, and he was only there to repeat it. Silco is very interested in the way language works, and the way language, words, potential words, have a kind of depth to them in the Gluna language, which Silco herself does not know how to speak. She has some ability with that language, but very little. Mostly her sense comes from her great-aunt Susie, who was a native speaker, but also had been trained in Western schools. So Susie was a kind of bridge person for her. Kouush continues talking in a soft, chanting voice, saying, maybe you don't know some of these things, vaguely acknowledging the distant circumstance of an absent white father, a reference to Teo's background. Teo's mother was somebody who was lost to the village, who was taken up by white men and basically prostituted herself and ended up dying. And so Teo has lost his mother, doesn't know who his father is. And so Teo is also a marginalized person there on the reservation. Not unlike Silco herself, who, because of her mixed blood background, was not allowed to experience some of the rituals and so on. So Silco herself is in some ways mirrored in this character. He called Josiah by his Indian name and said, if he had known then, maybe he could have told you before you went to the white people's big war. He looked at Teo's eyes and said, but you know, grandson, this world is fragile. This world is fragile. And then Silco writes this beautiful paragraph. The word he chose to express fragile was filled with the intricacies of a continuing process and with a strength inherent in spider webs woven across paths through sandhills where early in the morning the sun becomes entangled in each filament of web. It took a long time to explain the fragility and intricacy because no word exists alone. And the reason for choosing each word had to be explained with a story about why it must be said this certain way. That was the responsibility that went with being human, is knowing the stories behind all of these words. And so these words are like these spider webs. There's a sense of the intricacy, the sense of the interconnectedness of words. No word stands alone. All these words are connected. And the suggestion, I mean, part of the irony is that she is telling this, of course, in English. She, in a sense, is trying to translate this experience of the native word so we have a little bit of the feeling of what it would be like to be told a story in that language where each word would have a kind of resonance to it. And of course, in English, there's one place where that still occurs, and we call that poetry. Poetry really is an invitation to experience the resonance and depth in every single word. You take the word fragile, for example. Most of us could give a definition of what that word means. But if you're at all interested in etymology, you can go to a dictionary and you can trace the roots of that word. And the word root is a metaphor, obviously, here. But there's something very powerful about that. The sense of tracking a word down through history. And if you have an American Heritage Dictionary, an old one, in the back of old American Heritage Dictionaries, there was an Indo-European chart that would trace the word not just back to the old French, and then to the Latin, which is where fragile comes from, a French verb meaning to break. That's at the heart of the root of fragile. Our word frail shares that same root. If you had that American Heritage Dictionary, it would take you back behind the Latin to the Indo-European, which is before there was writing. So linguists speculate. They look at words in all these different languages and figure out far down what probably the root of the word was. It's fascinating. And so the interconnections, the weavings of words. I'll give you one simple example that I really love. Take the word guest and host. Guest and host share the same root. Now, knowing that, doesn't that say something? Isn't there meaning in that fact? Guest and host share the same root. The word hospital comes from that root. So does the word hostile.
Hospitality.
Hospitality. Yeah. Hostility. Striking. So there's this tension that's there in that root. Guest and host. Well, you can see perhaps why hostile and hostility come out of this. The guest is a stranger. And almost every old tradition suggests you must treat the stranger like he is your own kin, he or she is your own kin. But in opening your door to the stranger, you're also placing yourself at risk. Hence that notion of potential hostility that's there in the root. So English does have that capability. All right, so if we pick up on page 92, which is where the handout picks up, and if you have the book, and there is another handout, if you have the book, it's actually a different page, because it's a different edition, it's like on the dish there. So in the new edition, any of you looking on, we're going to be picking up right around the bottom of page 85. So we'll return to plot here briefly. One of the ways this novel is structured is that there is a continual movement in time in particular. It's not very linear as a novel. Many of my students find it extremely frustrating. They are not accustomed, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, it's like, this is not what they're used to trying to read. And they get confused, and there's no chapters in this book, as you might have noticed. There are no chapters, there are just these gaps, and then things move, and what's the connection, what's going on here? But that fluidity is really, that style, that structure is part of what her point, what she's saying, about a different way of experiencing reality. It's not designated in terms of chapters quite the same way. And this is actually a really good place to notice this. So at the bottom of page 92, we're gonna pick up with this short paragraph. Teo is with his aunt, who is kind of like the wicked stepmother in fairy tales. I mean, Rocky is her son, Rocky is the beloved, Rocky is the one who was supposed to leave the reservation, make good for the family and so on. Teo was supposed to take care of Rocky. What happens? Rocky gets killed, Teo comes home. And the aunt cannot forgive Teo for this. And she, of course, had to take Teo in because Teo is the son of her sister. But he's always marginalized. So here, she's talking about Josiah, who lives in this house as well. And Josiah is an uncle, not married to the aunt. And Josiah has gone off to spend time with a woman named the Night Swan, which we will meet in a few minutes. And the aunt is upset about this. This is not proper or appropriate. The aunt is Christian, but a Christian of a particular, rather harsh type. So, near the bottom of that page, this is Aunt, the aunt. Remember what happened to that dog? She seemed to be talking to both of them, old Grandma and Teo, although Teo had never even seen Pepper the dog. Her voice seemed to come from every part of the room. Pepper got run over on the highway, chasing some she-dog in heat. The warning is, this is like, Josiah is like the dog, and bad things are going to happen, and this is a guy who's out of control, he can't control himself, just like a dog, he's an animal, and so on. And then you get this big gap on the page. And does someone who read the next paragraph?
He remembered when his mother died. It had been dry then, too. The day they buried her, the wind blew gusts of sand past the house and rattled the loose tin on the roof. He never forgot that sound and the sand, stinging his face at the graveyard while he stood close to Josiah. He kept his head down, staring at small round pebbles uncovered by the wind. Josiah held his hand as they walked away from the graveyard. He lifted him into the front seat of the truck and gave him a candy cane left over from Christmas. He told him not to cry anymore.
So, I think actually it's not too hard to follow this gap in the page. Or, I don't know, is it? What's the connection?
Flashback
death? Yeah. Uh-huh. Specifically?
Pepper the dog and his mother, and
he's
drawing the connection.
Or
the gap is what's
drawing the connection. Yeah, yeah. So he hears the story about Pepper, who gets run over chasing some she-dog in heat. And there's a gap. And that space is a space of, I don't know, emptiness, or just that space, that brief instant that it takes for a memory to kick in. And Silco, I think, is like, you're following this trail in the song. Again, no chapter headings. There's not a lot of information. But she really is helping us out. He remembered when his mother died. Okay, well, sure. The dog has died, so there's a trigger. What's the connection between the dog and his mother?
Promiscuity.
Yeah, promiscuity. Promiscuity. And so the image of the dog and the way the aunt talks about the dog is the way the aunt talks about his mother. And so all these memories are triggered, the sense of loss, the sense of shame. It had been dry then too. So it's also the weather. And this is part of this notion about land. It had been dry then too. The dryness has a spiritual significance in this moment. Dryness, extended dryness, suggests that there is something wrong with not just the climate, but with an orientation in the world. If it's dry, there's something spiritually wrong. There is an illness in the land that is really also probably generated by the humans. And so if there is an illness, it's not just a matter of Teo trying to get cured, but there's also a relationship between Teo's illness and the illness of the land. There are reasons that critics have suggested that ceremony is a kind of grail story. If you know the grail legend, there is a king called the Fisher King. If you know T.S. Eliot's Wasteland, that's one place made famous. There is a king who is wasting away, who has been wounded, and all the land around the king is laid waste, is dry, and it requires some knight that has to come, ask the right questions in order to find the grail and so on and so forth for the healing to take place. There's often this connection between the individual illness and a larger community illness in the stories. If we think of Teo as insane, the word insane literally comes out of the Latin insanus, meaning out of health, basically. So insanity is a form of not being in health. This is where we started yesterday. Health, self, the word salvation is connected to this notion of health. So the land is dry now too. The day they buried her, the wind blew gusts of sand. So he's really, Silco is really emphasizing this dryness that has overtaken the land. He never forgot that sound in the sand stinging his face at the graveyard. I'm just repeating this to reinforce it. And then at the end of this paragraph, a strange detail. Josiah held his hand lifted in front of him, gave him a candy cane left over for Christmas, said to him, "Don't cry anymore." Okay, so this is English 101.
It's another kind of dryness.
Yeah, elaborate.
Well, not don't cry anymore.
Yeah, good. Okay.
The tears wash away the sadness and relieve you.
And so Josiah is being told, Teo is being told, and Josiah is the one person in his life who has, in a sense, nurtured him. And we can see that in the scene, actually. And Josiah is the only one who pays attention to him.
Well, and then he gets this candy cane too, but it's a leftover one, which means it's sort of not fully there, and that's supposed to somehow pay him back. Or give him a comfort when he's not allowed to cry anymore. And it's in itself damage.
Yes, it's an old candy cane left over from Christmas. Okay, Teo, your mother has just died. You have no father. You're living with an aunt now who doesn't care for you at all. You feel this is like a fairy tale. You are really abandoned. And what do you get?
An old candy cane.
And told not to cry. Yeah. And if we push that, which I think we can do, if we push it, well, okay, a candy cane is primarily sugar. So there is a temporary satisfaction. But there is no real nutritious value, we might say.
It's another thing about this. He's just a little boy because he picked him up and put him on the seat.
That's right.
So he's very young.
He's very young. He's very young.
It's very sad.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Okay, candy canes. Christmas. Well, we're in a novel called Ceremony. And we've suggested in a certain sense the whole novel takes place. is a kind of ceremony. Silva took this very seriously, and it's a big, and to me, interesting question. Can a work of literature, can a work of art, in a sense, be a ceremony? Can it bring about healing? This is, in some ways, the hypothesis that she's putting forth. The novel is a ceremony. Okay? Candy canes and Christmas? Obviously, part of a ceremony, and within a Christian context, a very significant ceremony. Christmas is the birth of Jesus, the birth of light, the return of light into the world. We were saying again yesterday, the winter solstice, you know, that you're moving deeper and deeper into darkness. there's this incredibly powerful feeling, even now with all of the electric lights and so on. I think we can still experience that sense as we approach the end of December. And then the Christmas ceremony, if one takes that seriously. And so somewhere in here is a profound ceremony and liturgy that speaks to a deep healing in the world. And what has that been reduced to?
Leftover
candy
with
cane.
No nutritional value.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what Teo gets of the Christian story. There is no real value there for him. It is clearly a substitute. And it is a substitute for mother. And so in a certain sense, again, as we continue, if you bear with us through Thursday, Teo's healing is going to be directly connected to re-finding his mother, in some sense. Mm-hmm. Obviously, literally, she is dead. But there is going to be some way in which he's... If there is going to be healing, there will have to be some kind of reconnection with the sense of the place of the mother. It's very strong in the song. Next paragraph. See, we could just spend all of September. Okay.
Classes must be very long.
They feel that way to some of us. It's like, come on, enough already. I had a student in the spring. We were doing ceremony on Native American ethnic class. She finally sat in the front line. She finally threw up her hands and said, you know, can't we just read the book and not have to think about it? It's like, you're in the literature. All right, let's see. If somebody would read the next paragraph for us. We got another gap, and then into this.
He knew the holy men had their ways during the dry spells. People said they climbed the trails to the mountaintops to look west and southwest and to call the clouds and thunder. They studied the night skies from the mountaintops and listened to the winds at dawn. When they came back down, they would tell the people it was time to dance for rain. Josiah never told him much about praying, except that it should be something he felt inside himself. So that last summer before the war, he got up before dawn and rode the bay mare south to the spring in the narrow canyon. The water oozed out from the dark orange sandstone at the base of the long mesa. He waited for the sun to come over the hills. He tied the mare to a juniper tree at the mouth of the canyon and walked up the narrow trail, with the cliffs closer on both sides as he walked farther into the canyon. The canyon was full of shadows when he reached the pool. He had picked flowers along the path, flowers with yellow long petals the color of the sunlight. He shook the pollen from them gently and sprinkled it over the water. He laid the blossoms beside the pool and waited. He heard the water flowing into the pool, drop by drop from the big crack in the side of the cliff. The things he did seemed right, as he imagined with his heart the rituals the cloud priests performed during the drought. Here the dust and heat began to recede. The short grass and stunted corn seemed distant.
Thank you. Beautiful day. The book reads well, love. And it helps to read it aloud. Again, the paradox of what Sokol is doing is here is somebody whose own direct connection to the oral tradition from which she comes is a bit remote. She has her Aunt Susie and a grandmother who shared some of the stories with her. There's almost no mention by Silko in her essays of her own mother, who apparently was working much of the time, not at home, and so not around to tell the story. So it was really these two people who were a little bit more distant. And she never did really learn the language. And so you can feel what she's trying to do. I mean, she feels this deep connection with this place. And she wants to find a way, in a sense, to claim it for herself, to root herself deeply in it. And her way to do that is through written English, not even oral storytelling in English, but through written English. She's a writer. And so a paragraph like this, again, gives us a little bit of that feeling, I think, as we hear it being read. It's a fairly long paragraph. There's no dialogue in it. Again, you can imagine my students. It's like they've got all this homework to do, and they come to a paragraph like this, and then you turn the page, and you look at the blocks of print on these pages, and you keep turning. It's like, oh, my Lord, where is there some dialogue here? Give me a break. I know it's 3 a.m. So very tempting to skim over something like this. Okay, so what's the transition? What's the thread, to use the metaphor that she works with, between that scene?
He's looking for rain.
Yes.
And water.
Pardon?
And water.
Yes, rain and water.
Maybe his tears.
That's nice. Yeah, his tears. That place of connection, that place of emotion. And of course, you know, we know this. We know the symbolism of water and rain. You know, we come a Christian culture where baptism is our entry into the faith, and baptism suggests something that has to die, a profound surrender, and then a birth of sorts into the church. And that image that I had of the baptistry, of that descent down into the water, and then rising up and entering the church, is a deeply symbolic. In those old cathedrals, again, Chartres is the one I know best, all the windows at Chartres tell the story. They tell the biblical story from Adam all the way to the book of Revelation in the judgment. This was an illiterate, this was a non-reading group of people for the most part. And so they would walk into that church, and that cathedral, that was their Bible. That they would read those images like it was comic book in a certain sense. And what that said was, as the light is streaming through those stained glass windows, that light is illuminating the entire story, the human story. It's very beautiful. Right? And they are contained within that story, in the space of the cathedral. That cathedral, which was often called Notre Dame, our mother, our lady. So you are inside the body of the mother, in some ways, in that cathedral. So there's this deep reconnection with the mother right there. And so you have the whole story, somehow, that you are inside that whole story. And it's not unlike what Teo, I think, ultimately has to experience. So, yeah, the dryness that he wants to find a cure for. He knew the holy men had their ways during the dry spells. He has a dim sense of this. He doesn't have a lot of information, but he's going to try and follow this. And this is past history. We hear Josiah never told him much about it, except that it should be something he felt inside himself. So not something just done by rote. And we can relate to this as well. You know, the importance of not just mechanically kind of going through the ritual. So that last summer before the war, and that's a time cue for us. It's like, oh, okay. We've got Teo in present time, after the war, when he is experiencing trauma and is deeply, deeply ill, remembering this experience way back when, just as he was remembering the death of his mother. So he got up before dawn, rides out, and we get this description, very rich and slow description of the landscape. And part of the idea is, the slowness of it, is an invitation for us to experience that landscape the way Teo is experiencing it. It requires a certain amount of patience. Holden should be a good place to read this all. Slow down. Appreciate the richness of this language. The canyon full of shadows. You pick flowers. Flowers with yellow long petals, the color of the sunlight. He shook the pollen from them gently, sprinkled it over the water. The things he did seemed right. There is a ritual-like quality in what he was doing here. And this is going to be very important when we get to Thursday. And the ending of the novel is Teo is faced with a really difficult decision about an action that he is, in a way, invited to act upon. And the yellowness of the flower, the pollen, all has significance within that Pueblo tradition. And it will come back at the end. I have alluded, it's just fascinating to me, if you've been attending any of Jonathan's talks, he's exploring, of course, this extraordinary problem of nuclear arms. And again, to jump ahead a little bit, to encourage you to come to this on Thursday, as we get to the end of this novel, there is a reminder that those the development of atomic warfare, to a great extent, was happening miles away from Leslie Silko's home on the Laguna Pueblo. We're talking about, of course, Los Alamos. And the uranium that was used at Los Alamos came from Laguna Pueblo. And so for Silko, there's something, it's like right there. It's right there in her homeland, which is supposed to be sacred land. And that's where this novel is going to be moving. Some kind of connection with that fact. What color is uranium?
Yellow. Yeah, exactly.
And so it's going to connect back up to this whole notion of sunrise. Right. This yellow pollen. Pollen, the function of pollen?
Fertilizer, reproduction,
exactly. New life and so on. Yeah.
It sort of sets the opposite to the duck chasing
That's right.
The bitch in heat.
Yeah. So there is an affirmation with the pollen, the gathering of the pollen. And this is, again, part of rituals for the Pueblo, as it was for the Navajo, collecting pollen, sprinkling it in certain places, and so on. I mean, there was a real alive sense about pollen as this living thing, life coming from this. So that's what Silko is awakening us to again. The things he did seemed right. He doesn't know the rituals, but there is something that he is following. And one can feel Silko in this as well. She does not know the rituals, but she is writing them out in a certain sense, tracking as a writer. There is some inspiration. There is something she's following as a writer that is very mysterious. Those of you who are artists know what this is like. You are just, you're following some kind of thread. Next paragraph.
The spider came out first. She drank.
Yeah, that's okay. We'll go ahead on that paragraph and come back.
No, that's fine. The air smelled damp, and it was cool, even after the sun got high enough to shine into the canyon. The dark orange sandstone formation held springs like this one, all along the base of the sandstone, where wind and erosion had cut narrow canyons into the rock. These springs came from deep within the earth, and the people relied upon them even when the sky was barren and the winds were hot and dusty.
Okay. So now we're in an extended narrative that's moving slowly, this past history, as Teo, as a young man before the war, is tracking something, tracking what the holy men did, trying to find his way into this way of bringing rain. Anything in this paragraph that stands out?
The color again, dark orange.
Yes, right. Yeah. The dark orange sandstone formation held springs, like this one. Mm-hmm. So we're finding water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's very deep.
These springs came from deep within the earth, which to me is a very, very resonant, had a lot of resonance to it. And so this water coming up, living water is what it is. This is living water. We have that expression, of course, in the Gospel of John. He's there with the woman, Samaritan woman at the well, and identifies himself. I am living water. Well, living water in the Jewish tradition actually had a very particular meaning. That was, it's water that had not been tampered with by humans. Water that came directly from springs, that was flowing, and so on. That's what, in a literal sense, living water meant. Jesus is identifying himself with that kind of water that is healing, that is nourishing, and so on and so forth. And of course, extending the meaning of that profoundly beyond just that literal sense. But it's still rooted in a desert climate where when you come upon a spring, it is literally life-giving. And any of you who've done hiking or backpacking in weather like this in the North Cascades or elsewhere probably have a little bit of a sense of what that's like. We carry water with us.
Lots.
Yeah. And, you know, we're told we shouldn't drink right from the springs here in these mountains because of Giardia and so on. It's a terrible loss. When I first was hiking, we would just dip our hands in. There's nothing more beautiful than that feeling. And so this is what Teo is touching upon for Silco. These springs came from deep within the earth. People relied upon them. The air smelled damp. So there's something coming alive here. And now I'm going to skip through because we're running out of time. We haven't even gotten to the next one yet. But the spider, that's important to drink. The spider came out first. He remembered stories about her at the very beginning. Those of you who were here yesterday, at the very beginning of the novel, we hear about Tsitsinako, thought woman who is identified with spider, grandmother spider. She is the mother figure in some ways, that creative source out of which everything comes. And so at this moment, for Teo to see the spider coming up has real significance to him. There is a sense of, again, new life, new possibility. So he remembers the stories, and then Silco repeats one of those stories that did, in fact, come from the Pueblo. The frogs come out on page 95. Dragonflies, page 95. They are all colors of blue, about two-thirds of the way down that page. They were all colors of blue, powdery sky blue, dark night blue, mountain blue. Stories about the dragonflies, too. He turned. Everywhere he looked, he saw a world made of stories. The long ago, time immemorial stories, as old grandma called them. It was a world alive, always changing and moving. If you knew where to look, you could see it, sometimes almost imperceptible, like the motion of the stars across the sky. And this is one of the places where Silco is inviting us into a perspective or a framework that clearly feels much more like health and balance and well-being. A world made of stories. Stories. Stories have meaning to them. The stories are what we would call myths, where the creatures like hummingbird, dragonfly, frog, and so on have human characteristics or are related to us. So are personified in some way. And if you want to push it far enough, you can simply do your biology 101 evolution and recognize, well, actually, yeah, we are all related. Frogs and dragonflies and humans, you go far enough back, we all come from one source, ultimately. What is the statistic about monkeys and chimpanzees and humans? It's like 99% DNA that we share, something like that. So, a world made of stories. It was alive, always changing, always moving. You know, a nice, there's no homework for this class, but I like to do homework. So a good homework assignment, just think about Holden in this context. You know, tomorrow, sometime, you know, at the Ark, just watch the community. And what you'll see is something like this. I mean, Holden, this is a pretty good description of Holden. Always changing, always moving. People will be coming in on the bus tomorrow. Other people will be leaving. Those of us who will be greeting those tomorrow will be those leaving the next day or whatever. Always fluid. And yet, there is this place called Holden. I mean, it's really quite miraculous. So, yeah, this place is not a bad description for this. Okay. So the next day, hey John, page 96. How are we doing? Do we need to stand up? Are we awake? Are we doing all right? I occasionally, with classes that where I can feel the energy drop, I'll just have to stand up and we'll like do 3 minutes of yoga. And they're all very embarrassed. And that wakes them up, if not. It's like, oh, no, no, no. Just keep talking. We're okay. We're okay. Although there's usually one student who really loves to lead yoga. Right? So, yeah. Everybody doing downward dog. It's quite hilarious in a classroom. So what happens next is rain finally comes. And with the rain, Josiah comes to Teo. This is middle of page 96. This rain spinning out of the thunderclouds like gray spider webs. So the rain is like spider webs. So she uses similes and metaphors to suggest these connections that are very real. The rain is connected to these webs, these threads that tie everything together. So Josiah comes up to Teo. We're still back in that earlier time. Hands him a piece of paper and says, "Can you take this note to her? I told her I would come this afternoon, but now with the rain, I will be too busy." So the rain that Teo is involved in somehow, he went out on this little ritual. The rain, in turn, makes it impossible for Josiah to meet the Night Swan, and so it's Teo who has to go to the Night Swan. And that makes him very nervous because of her reputation. This is a woman who came from who knows where, is living upstairs from a kind of bar, taverna, in this rather desolate place, and has a reputation possibly as a prostitute, a dancer, but very questionable character. Teo nodded. He could hear his heart beating. He was breathing fast. Something was shaking in his belly. The image of the belly comes up often in this novel. Teo, like a lot of his army buddies, drinks very heavily. He is on his way to being an alcoholic. He drinks in order to try to, say, drown out the memories, trying to bury the memories, trying to feel better. And it all settles in his belly. He's unable. It just doesn't work for him. And then you get, she had watched him all summer shift in perspective. We've been with Teo almost all the time. And so it's rather jarring, actually. This is, if you turn this into a movie, and we've got camera on Teo, we're getting Teo's perspective, and all of a sudden, yeah, it's like she had watched him all summer. It's kind of ominous, almost. She's got her eye on him, and we don't know. It's like, does she want to seduce him? What is this about? So he goes to her, 97. The rain is rattling on the tin roof. I'm about halfway down the page in that new long paragraph. He walked up the spiral staircase up to her room, smelling wet adobe plaster, listening to the rain. And then this, a scratchy Victrola was playing guitars and trumpets. A man sang sad Spanish words, E volvere, with the only words Tao understand. Those of you who were here yesterday, that should resonate, because at the very beginning of the novel, as Tao is in a nightmare state, he's got all these different languages and words moving through his mind. And one of the phrases is E volvere. This is after the war, and he's in this breakdown. And possibly not. And now we finally find out, almost 100 pages into the book, what the context is. And part of the meaning of that is that we are starting to put pieces together. That's one metaphor. It's like a puzzle. And it's part of the pleasure of the novel, is that, there's this aha moment. But another metaphor for it, of course, would be, here's one of these threads that was all tangled up in the beginning, that now we see the meaning of, not fully, but it's associated with the night swan, this Spanish word, and I will return, which also resonates with this sense of time and repetition, the cycle. So he goes in, next page, she invites him in. There's lots of references to blue, which reminds us of all those blues with the dragonfly. It's a kind of natural quality. The bottom of page 98, there's blue flowers, blue sheets, the rain pounding, of course, rain, water we associate with blue. There's something very healing, very cooling, very soothing about that. About four lines from the bottom, her long brown hair was curled and piled on her head in long ringlets. The style of some past time. She did not look old or young to it then. She was like the rain and the wind. Age had no relation to her. So, positive or negative, our sense of this woman at this moment?
Positive.
It feels that way, doesn't it? It's a beautiful, it's a very lyrical description. That is, she is associated quite literally with nature, with the land, the air. She was like the rain and the wind. It's very beautiful. Ageless. He goes in, the music stops. There's this image of wet rain, wet smells of rain. Light blue sheets twisted around his thighs and ankles. She whispers, and they're into, this is a sexual scene, clearly. And my students always, it's like, wait a minute here. I mean, he doesn't even know her. I mean, it's not like they've been dating. And I mean, they have a hard time with this scene. And we might as well. It's like suddenly they're in bed together, and how do you make sense of this? But in fact, throughout this passage, this woman is described in very positive ways. There is something going on here that is part of Tao's healing, in fact. Middle of page 99, her rhythm merging into the sound of the wind, the sound of the rain. He was lost deep beneath the surface of his own body and consciousness, swimming away from all his life before that hour. So there's this, he's being taken into a kind of death here. I mean, there's a kind of baptism almost, if you really want to push it. I have been watching you, she said. I saw the color of your eyes. I saw the color of your eyes. And that's explained pretty quickly here. Mexican eyes, he said, the other kids used to tease me. Presumably he has some Mexican blood in him. As blessing so good. The rain was only a faint sound on the roof, the sound of the thunder distant. Teo unbolted the door and opened it, watched the rain water pour out. I always wished I had dark eyes like other people. When they looked at me, they remembered things that happened. My mother. His throat felt tight. He had not talked about this before with anyone. Well, if there's any question about the importance of this moment for Teo, this is the first time. I mean, he, back at the beginning of the novel, when he's in the VA hospital, he can't speak at all. He is utterly shut down, closed off. And so suddenly, with this woman, he is able to say these words. He doesn't go, but my mother, my mother. She shook her head slowly. They are afraid, Teo. She has seen something with him. Something about, again, his mixed blood, something about his differentness that's going to be very important for the community. They are afraid. They feel something happening. They can see something happening around them, and it scares them. Indians or Mexicans or whites, most people are afraid of change. They think that if their children have the same color of skin, same color of eyes, that nothing is changing. She laughed. They are fools. They blame us, the ones who look different. That way they don't have to think about what happened, what has happened inside themselves. And of course, this resonates deeply. I mean, Leslie Silko lives in Tucson, Arizona. We know what's going on in Arizona right now in terms of immigration and so on. This fear of the other, this fear of change that is so deeply present in our culture, I think. And this is what the Night Swan is referring to. Something is happening. Something is changing very profoundly. Something needs to change. And there's part of each one of us, probably, that wants to stop it, wants things to remain the same. They are fools. She was looking at him intently. He felt uncomfortable. He walked over to the doorway, aware of the damp earth smell outside. So there too, just that little detail connects her with this earth. He had one hand on a screen door. You don't have to understand what is happening, but remember this day. You will recognize it later. You are part of it now. She was looking up at the pine vigas that held the roof. She turned her head and smiled. Ah, Teo, she said softly. And he felt that she cared a great deal about him. Goodbye, he said. Goodbye, Teo. Thank you for bringing message. Well, sure, the message from Josiah, which is simply, can't make it. But yeah, you know, thank you for bringing the message. It's a very loaded statement. And yeah, there's something, and where we're going to be going tomorrow is another encounter that Teo has with another woman. And to get a little bit ahead, both of these women, there's obviously very physical, there's this sexual relationship, but they are also somehow more than just ordinary women. I mean, they are also personifications of something that is connected to the earth, connected to the land, and is a kind of mother figure, as weird as it sounds, because it sounds like, oh, incest and you know, into an Oedipal story or something. But it's not, it doesn't play out quite like that. That's not the feeling we get. There is something maternal about the Night Swan, the way she cares for him. And yet at the same time, there is this merging, that sexual act suggests a kind of deep connection, intimacy, relationship, almost like she is that land. She is that rain. She is that water. That's what he is getting in touch with, it seems. You are part of it now. And so these words, too, suggest the Teo story is part of a longer, larger story that has real weight and resonance and significance. The dryness of the land, the need for healing. And Teo is just... He is an everyman figure. He's just like us. There's some sense that we too are part of a large story that has to do with healing at a very deep level. We all have some part to play in this story. And of course, within a Christian framework, we understand that. Every liturgy, every Vespers, we get a little bit of a taste of that. Oh yes, I am part of a very deep story. That is, member of the body of Christ. I'm a part of some kind of large pattern, which is a way of saying part of a story, and thus our lives have meaning. They're within this really big, meaningful, cosmic story. And so another homework assignment have I ever had that experience? Teo leaves the Night Swan, and those words, you are a part of it now. You may not understand it now, but you will someday. There's something large going on. Something important is happening. Have you ever had that experience? You don't have to answer it now. It's just a thought, just a question. And that, and being about 5 minutes over, we'll say thanks a whole lot.